Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 8, delivered on February 13, 2019. The title of this lecture is Present Value and Future Value.
Today, future value and present value. Now, I'm going to caution you that you probably, well, I'm almost sure they taught you this in accounting. Do you remember them teaching you how to go back to these tables and look for these factors to multiply by? Do you remember that at all? I hope you did. I hope you're not just all dead and asleep in here. But here's the fact of the matter. We don't use tables. We use these really weird things called calculators that can do that without having a needing a table. You'll never, as long as you have a TI 83 or 84 or a virtual simulator on your calculator, on your computer, or you can actually download, it's a little tricky to do it, a TI 83 for your smartphone too. If you want to see how to do it, you'll have to ask me because it's kind of a little tricky to do it. You have to write into the ROM of something. But anyway, enough of that. What I want to get to here is, let me get a marker out here, because I'm going to do a lot of writing tonight, and that means so will you. If I can find a marker that works, I'll be really happy. Oh, good. Marker works. Okay. Sir, I can give you $100 right now, or I can give you $100 in a year. Your choice. Which do you want? Now. Oh, sure. Instant gratification and all of that, right? Yeah. Now is preferred to later. Now is worth more than later. So I could say to you, madam, I will give you $100 in a year. But I could give you some money now instead. Would you be willing to accept a little less than 100 if you got it now?
Yeah.
Most people would. That is the beginning of the understanding of present value against future value. You see, when I say $100, actually that doesn't mean much because we haven't given it units yet. Well, how far is it to the restaurant? Oh, 12. Well, 12 what? 12 feet, 12 miles, 12 kilometers, 12 light years. You see, money has to have a unit, not just the denomination, dollars versus euros, or it also has to have a time on it too. Because $100 in a year is not the same as $100 now. Somewhere in your dark past, somewhere, I hope, you had an experience with doing unit conversions. You remember those unit conversions like 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters? That was a unit conversion. So, in other words, I could say, well, 20 inches. Well, what is that in centimeters? Well, I would take 2.54 centimeters per 1 inch. The inches would cancel, 20 times 2. And I would get 58, something like that. God, I so suck at arithmetic anymore. Calculator. Okay. Scientific. We'll need that for today. Okay, so 20 times 2.54, 50.8. Okay, great. Or someone could say, well, what about 45 centimeters? What is that in inches? You would say, oh, well, I do the reverse of that, so I got the cancellations to do it the right way, 1 inch over 2.54 centimeters, because then the centimeters would cancel, and I could do 45 divided by 2.54. Now you're wondering to yourself, why in the world are you showing me this? 17.72 inches. What I'm going to show you tonight is nothing but unit conversion. It's a unit conversion. It is exactly what I did here, except that we do it by a little bit more complicated formula. It's not terrible, but it's all we're doing when we turn dollars in one period into dollars in another period is just simply changing using a unit conversion. So, for example, if money occurs in 3 years, I can convert that money from 3 years out money to now money. That's all we're doing all night. And the four basic formulas are not all that complicated. There are a few little twists that can be taken, and we can make them a little more sophisticated. But the basis is simply that long, long time ago, interest was calculated by what is called simple method. In other words, if I told you 6% interest on $500, then I'd have my $500 plus whatever interest every year. 0.06 times 500 for 1 year plus 0.06 times 500 for the second year, etc. That's simple interest. It's very simple. Okay? We don't do that anymore. We still teach it because there are a few weird places that still compute interest in a simple manner. But almost never would you find a bank or any financial institution or financial market that functions on simple interest. Anymore, and for many, many, many years, many decades, we have used another method. You notice that the interest on this, in the simple interest method, all you're ever doing is calculating interest on the original principal. That's simple interest. We instead calculate interest on what has occurred as far as principal and interest for the previous period. So in other words, in the first period, yes, it would be 6 times 500 plus the original 500. But in the second period, it would be that 500 times 1.06 plus the original 500. We compound now. We use compound interest. Now, the formula itself is actually painfully simple, although there's a little bit of math that you have to remember from somewhere in your dark past. First things first, the basic formula is that the future value of money is going to be its principal value, what it is worth now, times 1 plus r to the t power. Now here's where you have to watch it. Because this r is the periodic interest rate. This T is the number of periods. Interest rates are almost always quoted annual, an APR, an annual percentage rate. So you have to make the adjustment in the formula. Now, if there's only one period per year, in other words, if compounding is annual, then the R that you use is the APR. However, you put $500 into an account that pays, excuse me, 6% interest compounded semi-annually. How much is in the account after 10 years? Semi-annual means that the interest is calculated twice a year. So in a case like this, the R you would use is 6% divided by 2. And the T you use would be 10 years times 2, because there would be 20 calculations over the life. So in other words, using that formula right there, what I would do is I would say that the future value is your principal value, 500, times 1 plus 0.06 over 2 to the 10 times 2 power. Big thing, big minor detail. Do not try to use intermediate calculations. Try your best to run the calculations all in one string. Scientific calculators understand hierarchy of operations very well. Strangely, business calculators don't. So if you said 2 plus 3 times 4 on a scientific calculator, you'd get the right answer, 14. But if you said 2 plus 3 times 4 on a business calculator, you'd get the wrong answer. You'd get 20. It's been that way. It just drives us crazy. Business calculators have not been able to do arithmetic hierarchy since they started coming on the market in the late 70s and early 80s. They just never could. So you should be using a scientific calculator. That's why I always want you to get a TI-83-84 or an Inspire, TI-Inspire. Let me show you here. Run it as a single run calculation. 500 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 2, close the parenthesis, and then raise that to the open parenthesis, 10 times 2. Now you're saying to yourself, well, I could do some of those in my head. Yeah, for this simple problem, but if you've got like 6.82% and you've got 12 periods per year or whatever, then it's not as easy. But here, $903.06. Is that right? Did I do that right? Seems like a pretty substantial. Okay? Not hard at all. And as you can see, the compounding is pretty nice on that one. The 10 years, you've almost doubled your money just leaving the stupid money alone. This kind of goes to the old thing I've been already harping about. Don't play with your stupid portfolio. Leave it alone. Compounding a stock price will grow your portfolio as long as you don't keep jumping and hopping up and down and barking. Just leave it alone, and after 10 years, you almost doubled your money here. Now, here's an interesting thing. The next thing, that's compounding. Now, I said semi-annual. That means twice a year. So I use a 2. If I say quarterly, what would I use? How many quarters are in a year? Yes, 4. I didn't mean to be complicated about that. If I said biannually, let me not do that one. What about monthly? Monthly, what would I use? Good. Now, here's the one that bugs me sometimes. If I said weekly, what do I use? Madam? That's good. You would not believe how many people ask me how many weeks are in a year. I mean, I had a test a couple of years ago. I had on it a weekly compounding. It wasn't a hard problem. This young woman comes up and she says, how many weeks are in a year? So I decided, wow. And I said, you want to know how many weeks are in a year? And I had like 20 people say, yeah, how many weeks are in a year? Oh, okay, there's 52. Damn it. Yeah. Along the way here, by the way, what if I said semi-monthly? What would that be? How? What? 24, yes. What if I said bi-monthly? 6. Semi means twice in every period, a month. Bi means once every 2 of the periods. So keep that in mind. Sometimes you'll see bi-weekly, which would be a 26 instead of a 52. By the way, what if I said daily? You're mumbling, woman. Yeah, 365. Now, interestingly, though, that's not as easy as it sounds. In your textbook and in an elementary course like this, you would use 365 here and here. But in actual practice in finance, we would use 360 here and 365 up here, oddly. And the usual explanation is that there are 360 bankers' days in a year. The real reason, which is almost lost to history now, is that the number 360 there's a trick for dividing numbers by it. And I used to remember it exactly. It was amazing. But back before there were calculators and all of that, with that 360, you could divide if you had daily compounding, you could divide the interest rate by 360 by this trick very quickly. And like I said, it's been lost to history how the trick works for most people. I've still got it in my notes somewhere from my college days. But anyway, anymore, we don't need to worry. We got the calculators that do all this kind of stuff. So it's the 360 here, the 365 there. However, if I'm not mistaken, if they didn't revise it in this latest edition of the book, just use 365 both places. Interestingly, though, if you use 360 down here, it benefits the investor because the interest rate divided by 360 is a larger number to take to a power than the interest rate divided by 365, just slightly. Oh, but there you are. That's how. That's neither here nor there for us. But that is the basis. Now, let me show you something interesting here. If I did the 6% annual, semi-annual, monthly, weekly, and daily. on the same account. Now, on the annual account, and I'll try to run this as fast as I can. If you see me type key something in wrong, for God's sake, say something. 500 times 1.06. That would just be annual to the 10th power. 895.42. Semi-annual, well, I did that one. That was 903.06. Monthly, times 500 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 12, close the parenthesis, to the open parenthesis, 12 times 10, 909.70, weekly, I do 500 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 52, close the parenthesis, to the open parenthesis, 10 times 52, close the parenthesis, 910.74, daily, be $900, probably $11, something along there, 500 times open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 360, close parenthesis. Oh, I did three, old habits. Y to the X, open parenthesis, 10 times. $918.64. Now, there's actually also a continuous. It doesn't work the same way. It's its own formula. It's the natural constant e to the interest rate. But never mind that. Okay. But you notice something. As the number of compounding periods per year increases, the actual amount of money you earn increases. So in other words, the effective rate you get becomes different from the APR, the annual percentage rate. In fact, we have a nice little compact formula. If you want to find the effective rate, now, you'll hear me actually use the term effective yield. All you do, don't do anything but this. Just take 1 plus the APR divided by the number of compoundings per year, and just take that to the number of compoundings per year. Don't get fancy. So in other words, if I wanted to know the effective rate, if the APR is 6% and I have, let's say, monthly compounding, all I would do is just take 1 plus 0.06 divided by 12 to the 12th power. Oh, minus 1, I'm sorry. I always forget that minus 1. Did it this afternoon, do it every semester. So in this case, I just do 1 plus 0.06 divided by 12, close the parenthesis, and then raise that to the 12th power minus 1. 6.17%. So the effective rate is actually above the APR. This is a benefit to investors, to depositors in savings accounts. It's also, interestingly enough, a detriment to borrowers. So in other words, when you get a car loan with an APR of 6.99%, well, you're going to make your payments monthly. That means that the effective rate on the loan is actually higher than 6.99%. In other words, if you get a loan with an APR of 6.99%, by the nature of the loan, you're compounding monthly. So the actual effective rate on the loan would be 1 plus 0.0699 over 12 to the 12th power minus 1. So what you're really paying on the loan is not 6.99%. It's, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0699 divided by 12, close a parenthesis, to the 12th power minus 1. So your interest rate is actually 7.22%. Now, by law, they have to disclose the effective rate somewhere in the loan agreement, in the contract. But it's not what you will see advertised and all of that. Sometimes they'll put the effective rate in small print in a TV ad. But you've got to watch out, because that's actually noticeably higher than what you think you're paying in interest rate. Now, where did this come from? Why did we do this? This is one of those places where I get an entry point to telling you the backstory of the economy and finance, and it has use to us later. You see, back before the 1930s, there was a rock-solid philosophy of governance that said, leave markets alone. There is no place for government to regulate free markets. People are free, so business should be free. No government regulation. The smallest government is the best government, and all of that. Well, the 1920s were called the Roaring Twenties, not because everyone was roaring. Actually, as the 20s were proceeding, the distance between the very wealthy and the middle class, the working poor, and the poor was widening dramatically. You could see that something was going to break, but no one cared. Because the government was the best government money could buy in Washington, D.C. They were bought and paid for from the president on down. And this had been the way it had always been. You hear your great presidents, your bad presidents, they were all bought and paid for. So were the senators and representatives. And none of them was going to crack down on all of the scams that were running. Security scams, investment scams in general, banks that were just nothing but paper thin, sod banks, con artists were running banks, the whole nine yards. Give you an idea of one of the schemes. Okay, madam, you give me $1,000 and I promise you I will give you back in 1 year $1,500. Well, now you would say, well, that's a mighty fine deal there, sir. Here's my $1,000. So you know what I do with that $1,000? I spend it. As we used to say, wine, women, and song. Well, for me, you know, forget those. Cat food and a steak, and I'm good. Cat food for the cats. They have a very delicate constitution. Okay. So now, a year later, I need to give you back your $1,500, give you $1,500. 50% interest rate, APR, $1,500. So what I do is I come to you, sir. What I need from you is for you to invest $5,000 in my investment plan, and I will give you back in 1 year $10,000. Guaranteed. And so if I can convince you to do it, you give me $10,000 or $5,000. I take $1,500 and pay it back to you. This is the important part, by the way, in this kind of scam. You get your $1,500. I got $3,500. I can buy a bigger steak. I can buy better cat food. I can buy a couple of extra things. I can even buy some friends for the night. Shut up. So now it's time for me to get you back your $10,000. Sir, I need you to invest $20,000 in what I will do for you, and I've been in business long enough. Notice there's a D in business. It's not business, it's business. I've been in business long enough to guarantee you that if you were to give me $20,000 in 1 year, I'd give you back $80,000. Now you're saying to yourself, I don't believe a thing you're saying, and you're right. You should not believe it. Ask that young lady down there. Did I give you back what I promised? By God, I did. And as the Lord is my witness, I will for you as well. You see, that first step is absolutely critical to get her back her money, because then she unknowingly becomes my best advertisement. You give me that money, and I will just keep this scam going until it finally breaks and I can't find any more investors, and then I leave town. I get out of New York City. I move myself to some quiet place on the other side of the planet, because it turns out you had a firearm that was pretty damn impressive. But you see how it worked? You think, oh, this couldn't happen. It happened all the time in the 20s. There was no one to take these people to prison, to send them on their way. There was no one who could stop them. And the more money they had, the more that they could pay to the politicians to buy their silence. The more I could take care of the police, the more I could take care of the judges. And the scams went on and on and on. Last year at the internship fair, the state attorney's office was there looking for finance and accounting people. He said, there are so many scams going on right now. He said, and we just don't have the expertise. We don't have the manpower to handle it. So when we got this one, he was telling, he said, we got this one, $20 million bank scam. We can't do a thing about it. We turned it over to the Highway Patrol. The Highway Patrol said, what the F are we supposed to do with this? Back to the 20s we go. But anyway, it all came to a crashing halt in 1929, with the collapse of the stock market. The economy was spiraling hard and fast into what would become the worst recession in American history, the Great Depression. And so in 1932, all of the scoundrels in Washington, from the president to the senators to the representatives, they were all kicked out. The rage was real, and it was fiery. It wasn't just the financial scams. It was the lies, the coddling, the corruption, and a couple of horrific incidents where those wealthy, powerful people were threatened by the poor people, and the poor people were killed. So read that in, for example, the Bonus March. So they were kicked out, and an era of hardcore reformers came in, like this country had never seen before and has actually never seen since. These reformers, from the president on down through the senators and the House of Representatives, started laying in laws. No, the littlest government isn't the best government. The strongest, iron-fisted government is the best government. And they passed laws to govern securities. That would be the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, to control labor abuses of workers. That would be the National Labor Relations Act, to control abuses in all kinds of industries and in banking as one of those. The informal name of the act was Glass-Steagall. I think that's how you spell Steagall. The Glass-Steagall Act. This just put an iron fist of regulation. For one thing, Glass-Steagall said banks that take care of regular people, depositors and borrowers, they may not have investment bank operations. You see, because if you are running an investment bank, doing stock offerings for fancy companies, and you're the same bank that is helping people saving their earnings for the future, you have a direct incentive to take your dog investments and sucker these people who are just wanting to save their money. So they put up what we call a Chinese wall between investment banking and commercial banking. They did other things. No, Mr. Bank, you can't run an insurance company at the same time. Again, conflict of interest. And they also cracked down on ludicrous interest rates. You cannot offer 50%. In fact, interestingly enough, now understand that this was in the context of a crashed, destroyed economy. So essentially, the Federal Reserve was just printing money, hand over fist, truckloads, shiploads of money. So remember, interest rates are the price of money. So as the supply of money went up, interest rates had gone down dramatically. In fact, they had gone so low that we have a couple of places during that period when interest rates went negative, something that is just amazing, at least some interest rate. The Glass-Steagall Act set the maximum rate that could be offered on a passbook savings account at 5.25%. Now, oddly, though, interest rates were so low that even though this is what in economics we call a price ceiling, it had no effect because interest rates were way below that anyway. So bankers, you know, ethical, good bankers didn't fuss at all. We're offering 1% right now. Who would ever see a 5.25%? So that set a price ceiling of 5.25%. Now let's reel forward in time. We actually began to crawl out of the Great Depression in 1934, but we teetered back into it in what's called a secondary recession in 1936, I believe it was. So, you know, interest rates were holding low, trying to get the economy to crawl out. The problem really began to become more noticeable with that price ceiling there when we began these utter sons of bitches bomb Pearl Harbor, and then we decided it was time to take on those Nazis, those filthy Nazis in Europe, and then the government was spending money to bring the economy out of the recession, and then you talk about spending money. We had really no war machine at all. We had a bunch of ugly-ass stuff that from World War I, but we really had not been building an engine of war since then. So we had to come from a very low place, get factories up and running, get people working in those factories, get war material built, bullets, food, transportation logistics, jeeps, anything, fighter planes, bombers, ships, so much had to be built. The government was starting to borrow money, just hand over fist. And of course, as the government borrowed money, demand for loans became greater, which drove interest rates up. And the truth be told, for the first couple of years of the war, we were getting our asses kicked. We were taking on the Japanese in the Pacific. They were wrecking us. And we just had to just keep pouring money in until we had the war materiel, the experience, and the leadership to be able to start to turn the tide of the war. Tremendous amount of money. So interest rates were beginning to push upward. And they were beginning, interest rates on some investments were beginning to bump against this price ceiling. Boom, boom, like that. And of course, you know, the banks, you know, someone's offering 5.30% interest. People are going to go invest in that instead of putting their money in a passbook savings account. We got a problem here. Hence, compounding began to happen. The bankers and their lawyers look through the Glass-Steagall Act. There's nothing that says we can't compound more than annually. Well, what happens if we begin to compound semi-annually? Well, suddenly, by the book, by the letter of the law, we've got 5.25%, but in terms of finance, we've got 1 plus 0.0525 over 2 to the second power minus 1 as the actual effective yield. And if I do that very quickly, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2, close the parentheses, to the second power minus 1, 5.32%. So in other words, by compounding, they could slide around the price ceiling set by the Glass-Steagall Act. It wasn't against the law, and it was actually necessary for the banks to survive because they were competing with other investments that were offering a little more than what they were by law allowed to. And so compounding became a thing simply to end around price ceiling. And then it got to be so common that most financial institutions, they said, oh, fine, okay, whatever. We'll offer compounding. Well, they offer compounding. And a lot, truth be told, a lot of people didn't really even understand what compounding meant. But they knew that compounding was something that was a positive. So if you were offering compounding every quarterly compounding, well, by God, I'm going to offer it every month. Monthly compounding, daily compounding, hell, hourly compounding. It became more of a marketing thing as time went on. And so that's where compounding actually came from, is that modest time back then. I do want to bring up one last thing. The Glass-Steagall, it was repealed in 1999. A right-wing conservative Congress paired with a neoliberal president, both of them quite happy to do what business was crying about. We're mature. We would never do that again. We can watch ourselves now, officer. And so Glass-Steagall was repealed. And of course, then we had catastrophes happen. Like 2008, when the whole planet almost went into a financial apocalypse that would have turned the lights off on civilization. We were about 2 hours from it, truth be told. But Glass-Steagall is gone now. It's gone. Banks can go back to offering whatever they want. The regulators have to be careful about hurting the feelings of banks now. Banks can have investment banks in commercial banks, insurance companies, they can do captives, whatever the hell they want. Because remember, banks can take care of their own problems. Like hell they can, but there you go. That's your problem. It's your world, not mine now. Sorry, that's insensitive. Where the hell was I? Ah! Now let's take the flip side of this. I have to tell you something that probably is going to bother you, madam. I know, it's, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're my daughter. No, seriously, that's really dramatic. Because I am going to live another 10 years, and then I'm going to die, and I'm going to give you $10 million in my will. I mean, yeah, being raised by me really messed you up. You should see my real kids. I mean, they are just... Well, anyway, you see, the thing, though, is that that's 10 years from now. So that's $10 million, but it's really not $10 million to you right now. It is considerably less. Wouldn't it be nice if someone offered you some amount of money, instead of the $10 million in 10 years, someone said, well... The old geezer is going to kick off in 10 years, unless we can figure out something to put in his coffee to, you know, finish him off before then, put him out of his misery. But in 10 years, I'll tell you what. This guy comes to you and he says, I will give you something less than $10 million, but I'll give it to you right now. If it was the right amount, you'd probably say yes to taking a lesser amount now than $10 million in 10 years, right? Okay, that's the other side of the coin. The present value. You see, I can just rearrange this formula, and I can just divide both sides by the 1 plus r to the t, and I can find the present value of a future amount of money. Now, I want to point out something here from algebra. Well, it's actually arithmetic, but it is algebra too. You see, when you divide by something to a power, it's the same thing as multiplying that something to the negative of that power. So in other words, I can write the present value formula PV as PV equals FV times 1 plus R to the negative T. Now, I show this to you because it looks sophisticated, and we all want to look sophisticated, right? That's why we put on nice clothes when we go to Walmart. But it's also practical because you will find that you will be less likely to make a mistake this way, dividing by a complicated little piece of formula. I guarantee you, I will screw it up almost every time. It's actually a little bit better as far as not getting a mistake, having a mistake happen, if you do it this way. So in other words, that $10 million, let's suppose that this deal maker figures, well, I could take, you know, I could invest at about 6% on a risk-adjusted basis. So what he's going to say is, let's say 6%. So he'll say, I'm going to discount that money back, $10 million. compounded annually, just to make it simple, like that. Now, I could compound it something other if you could find a compounding investment. But, so I'm going to say, what, 10 million times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06, close the parenthesis, y to the x, 10, pos neg. $5,583,974. $5,583,947.77. That's the present value. Now, as I pointed out, in accounting you were shown this, but they had you do it with tables instead of a formula. Am I right about that? You should have seen, they're still talking using tables, at least some of the professors are. We would never use tables for this kind of nonsense. We just simply use a formula. And that's how you would find the present value of a future amount of money. You see, as I said at the beginning, what we're doing with these formulas is simply a unit conversion. $10 million in 10 years is equal to 5.583 or 5.584 million now if you discount at 6%. A little terminology here. When you're carrying money forward, we say we're compounding. When we carry money backward, we say we're discounting. I think you'll have a problem in your homework that actually asks that. When you carry money forward, when you're finding a future value, you say you're compounding. When you're carrying money backward, when you are finding a present value, we say you're discounting. Now, here's the practical upshot of that, which is at the core of one of the major areas of finance, is that this is how we decide whether or not we are going to take on a project. This is how we do it. Now, we'll use a little bit more sophisticated stuff, and the calculator will make it pretty easy for us. But let me show you this. Suppose that you have an investment of $300 that you need to make right away. In 1 year, you'll get back $102. In 2 years, you'll get back $104. And in the third year, the final year, you'll get $108. Do we accept this project or do we reject it? It is actually very simple. All we do is bring back these future amounts to the present. So the first one would be the 102 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative 1. Add to that the 104 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative 2, and then add the 108 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative 3. Now watch what happens when I do that. 102 times 1.06 to the negative 1 plus 104 times 1.06 to the negative second plus 108 times 1.06 to the negative third. Did I screw something up? Oh, I sure did. wonder if I can back out. Let me do it one more time here. 102 times 1.06 to the negative 1 plus 104 times 1.06 to the negative 2 plus 108 times 1.06 to the negative 3rd, 279.47. We reject the project. We say no, because the present value of the future expected cash flows isn't as much as how much you have to pay for it right now. The now value of these cash flows out here is less than the now value of your investment. So you say no. This is how we say yes or no to projects. We compare the present value of the future positives to the now value of what you have to put in to get it. And in this case, it's a no. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.